Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. If you or someone you love has been diagnosed with breast cancer, you're probably confused, afraid, perhaps even angry. But you are not alone. More than 2 million women in the United States today are breast cancer survivors. Where are we in the fight against breast cancer and what more needs to be done? Let's take note with Dr. Monica Morrow, a renowned surgical oncologist who has been credited with making huge contributions worldwide to developing standards of care for women with breast cancer. Dr. Morrow is Chief of Breast Surgery Service with the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning.
What are among the most significant advances in the fight against breast cancer?
Well, I think the advances come both in terms of improved treatment as well as fewer side effects of treatment. So improved treatment, we now offer women who need surgery a choice between mastectomy, complete breast removal, or the ability to preserve their breast by taking out the cancer, which is a lumpectomy, and then giving radiation to the rest of the breast. Breast reconstruction has come a long way as a viable option for many women. In the past, we used to have to take out all of the lymph nodes under the armpit in order to find out whether or not there were cancer cells there, which is an operation that's associated with a lifetime risk of arm swelling or lymphedema. Today, we can now identify the lymph nodes where cancer is most likely to go first, which is called sentinel lymph node biopsy. Just take out those nodes, and if they're free of cancer, save the rest of the nodes. Far fewer side effects, and in fact, lumpectomy and sentinel node biopsy is an outpatient operation. In the past, we also knew that in spite of our best surgery, many women would die of breast cancer. Now we have improved drug therapies, and we've begun to separate women with breast cancer into different groups. So those whose breast cancers contain the estrogen receptor get the most benefit from anti-hormone therapies like tamoxifen. Those who overexpress HER2, which is an abnormal gene in the cancer, have a targeted therapy called Herceptin or trastuzumab, and for the rest, conventional chemotherapy.
Do women understand their choices when it comes to treatment for breast cancer, and how do they make those choices?
Well, that's an area that has been relatively understudied and a particular interest of mine. And although 80% of women of all ages will tell you that they are quite confident or fairly confident with their treatment choice, so they believe they understand, our research shows that within 6 months of diagnosis, only half of them can tell you that the chances of surviving breast cancer are exactly the same whether you have a mastectomy or a lumpectomy. I don't know how you can make that treatment choice without understanding that fundamental fact.
What difference does geography make in terms of the treatment that you'll get? In other words, if you live in the South as opposed to outside of Philadelphia, do women across the United States have the same opportunities for good treatment?
Well, they may have the same opportunities, but they clearly are receiving different treatments. So that, for example, the use of lumpectomy and radiation instead of mastectomy, much more common on the East Coast, much more common on the West Coast than in the central parts of the country like the South and the Midwest. We see the same variation with radiation, but it's not only access to care that in more rural states, for example, it would be difficult to come back and forth for radiation, because when you compare mastectomy rates in the United States to those in industrialized European countries, they're actually much higher.
Speaking of other countries, we know that breast cancer rates vary dramatically from one nation to another. What can you tell us about why women living in North America have the highest rate of breast cancer in the world?
Well, part of it is because of some good things, namely that women live a long time here, and half of your breast cancer risk occurs after the age of 65. Also because with good nutrition, you get your period earlier, and that's associated with an earlier onset of breast cancer. So, for example, in Japan since World War II, as nutrition has improved, we've seen an increase in the breast cancer rate in Japan as well. Things that seem obvious on the basis of those geographic variations, like maybe a low-fat diet would reduce breast cancer, we've tried very hard to study that and have been unable to prove that that's true.
Federal data that was released in 2006 showed that the rate of breast cancer stopped rising in 2001 and started falling in 2003. I'm wondering, was that an anomaly, or do you think that's a trend that we can expect to continue? And if so, why?
Well, we've seen several good trends in breast cancer. One is the trend in breast cancer incidence that you're talking about. And there was concern at first when incidence dropped off a little that maybe this was because fewer women were screening. But it turns out we're still seeing incidence go down. That may be partially due to the decline in use of postmenopausal hormone replacement therapy that has clearly happened in the last few years. It may also be due to the fact that some drugs that are used to treat osteoporosis in high-risk women have a beneficial effect of reducing breast cancer, and so that may be starting to show up. And we're also seeing a decline in breast cancer death.
According to studies, chemotherapy is very effective for different kinds of leukemia, but not effective for all kinds of breast cancer, and yet lots of women do undergo chemotherapy. When is it advisable and when isn't it?
Well, if you have a breast cancer that is what we call triple negative, it has no estrogen receptor, it has no progesterone receptor, which is the other hormone receptor, and it has no HER2, we have no treatment options except chemotherapy at this point in time. I think a big advance, in the past, we knew that women whose cancer had the estrogen receptor got their primary benefit from drugs like tamoxifen, but if you took 100 women and gave all 100 of them chemotherapy, 5 would benefit. We couldn't pick out the 5, so we gave all 100 chemotherapy. Now we have a gene test, and by testing 21 genes in the cancer, you can actually predict who the group of women who will benefit from the addition of chemotherapy actually is and who the ones who won't benefit are.
And apparently there's also now a computer tool to determine which women are most likely to have their breast cancer return.
Right. That tool is called Adjuvant Online, and it takes the information about you and your cancer that we know determines outcome and tells you what the risk of recurrence will be if you were to receive no treatment and how much benefit a group of women like you would get from being treated. So it's a way of trying to take into account individuals' preferences for how much benefit is necessary to go through the sometimes toxic side effects of chemotherapy.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but a moment ago you said that women who have had lumpectomy and other procedures have the same chances for survival of those who've had total mastectomy. Why are women still choosing total mastectomy then?
Well, I think because it seems like bigger is better, and they don't really hear that message that, in fact, survival is the same because everyone has been focused on the issue of recurrence of cancer in the breast itself. If you don't have a breast, cancer isn't going to recur in your breast. So it's like doing 100 mastectomies now to prevent the fact that you might have to do 5 over the next 10 years, which is what the numbers are.
You've been involved nationally, really worldwide, in establishing standards for breast-conserving therapy. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this was an effort that started quite a while ago now when we saw that in spite of the fact that women seemed to be asking for lesser surgeries back 25 years ago, not just asking but demanding, but the uptake of lumpectomy was very low. And this was initially thought to be due to surgeon resistance to doing it. So the National Surgical Organizations, Pathology, and Radiology Organizations got together as a group and said, we're going to develop guidelines so that everyone understands how we interpret the facts today and can apply these. And that's what began that effort.
Speaking of applying things, for every type of cancer, there is usually at least one experimental clinical trial that patients may be eligible to participate in. And among other things, your research is focused on how to apply the advances, what you've learned from those, into real practice. I want to begin by asking, who should participate in a clinical trial and why?
Well, virtually every woman who's eligible for a clinical trial will benefit by participating. And that's because clinical trials, at least the ones that are funded by federal research agencies, compare the current state-of-the-art treatment to something that is promising enough that we're willing to invest millions of dollars in it to study it. So no matter which arm of the clinical trial you get in, you're guaranteed to get a good treatment. And a lot of women say, well, I don't want to be a guinea pig. I want my doctor to tell me what to do. Well, when somebody tells you what to do, they're only giving you your opinion. If they knew, we wouldn't be spending $20 million to ask the question.
But clinical trials have gotten a black eye in recent months. There have been a number of stories in the news about pharmacology where outcomes have not been very promising and they haven't been published, or people were given something or not given something that may have helped them.
Well, it's important to distinguish among clinical trials. That is certainly not the case in federally funded clinical trials. The pharmaceutical industry sponsors a lot of good research, but the purpose of their research is by and large to bring their drugs to market. And so when the results don't look good, the results may not be forthcoming very rapidly. There are a lot of efforts underway to change that, but again, I would say they don't apply to federally funded trials.
So that's the question to ask. Is this a federally funded trial?
Right.
We tend to think of cancer as a ticking time bomb, regardless of how much success or advancement there's been. Once there's a diagnosis, many patients think that they have to act immediately, especially when cancer is involved. What advice do you have, though, in terms of making the best use of precious time, money, and energy?
Well, I would say stop, take a deep breath, and know that a long time ago, a study was done which looked at the outcome of women who had their breast biopsy and their definitive surgery, which was mastectomy at that time, all on the same day, compared to those who had a biopsy and waited up to a month to have their treatment, and there was no difference between the two. So if you really want to participate in your treatment choices, you need to take the time to gather information about where you want to be treated, which physician you want to be treated by, what clinical trials are available, and really think about that and know that anybody who tells you, oh, if you don't get this operated on within the next 2 or 3 days or a week, is probably more worried about their own schedule than any medical facts about you.
Well, speaking of schedules, how do you find the right doctor, and how important is it that you get a second opinion?
Well, interestingly, second opinions, to start with that one first, today there's about a 20% chance that your second opinion will tell you something different than what your first doctor told you. So I think if you go somewhere and your doctor says to you, here are the treatment options, and I don't think you're appropriate, for example, for lumpectomy for these reasons, then you may have heard it. If, on the other hand, somebody says, you need to have a lumpectomy because I only do lumpectomies, then you might want to get a second opinion. If you are seen by what's called a multidisciplinary group, doctors of different specialties, so you see a surgeon, you see a radiation doctor, you see a medical oncology doctor, you've gotten basically three opinions in one day. Nothing wrong with getting a second opinion. Chances of it changing your treatment, about 20%.
Well, speaking of opinions, the rule of thumb was a mammogram every year after age 40. Now I'm hearing that every other year may be just as effective. And of course, lots of us have heard stories of women who had clean mammograms but then found breast cancer through self-breast exams.
I think up until the age of 70, a mammogram once a year does remain the standard. By going year by year, you have a greater chance of picking up subtle differences and smaller cancers. We know that from some of the European countries where they do every other year mammography for cost reasons. In terms of mammography finding all cancers, no, it doesn't find all cancers. It's not a perfect tool, but we know it increases the likelihood of finding your cancer when it's small enough to be treated by a lumpectomy, and it decreases your risk of dying of breast cancer. There's no other screening test that does that.
Women sometimes complain that their breasts are not symmetrical, and beyond not liking them, is there a link between asymmetry and cancer?
No. That's one of those myths, just like underwire bras, antiperspirants. None of those things have anything to do with the risk of developing breast cancer.
Let's talk then about genetics, because we have heard a lot about advances in breast cancer and genetics, and many people have read about women who have, because they have this genetic marker or predisposition, have opted for total mastectomy when they are cancer-free.
Right. So there's two different kinds of genetics. There's the genetics of the cancer itself, which we use to determine treatment. And then there's a group of women we can identify as being at increased risk of breast cancer because there's an abnormal gene, BRCA1 or BRCA2, passed through their family from either the mother's side or the father's side. Only 5 to 10% of women with breast cancer have those genes, but if you have a gene, you have an extraordinarily high lifetime risk of getting breast cancer, which is in some cases as high as 80%. So some of those women do feel like they have a ticking time bomb. They choose to have their breasts removed to reduce that risk below 10%.
This year, 2008, more than 40,000 women will die from breast cancer. But the good news is that there are 2.5 million breast cancer survivors out there right now. What factors will determine or influence, rather, who will die and who will survive breast cancer?
Well, part is determined by the biology of the cancer itself, and that we can't change. The other part, though, is determined by the treatment that you receive, and that's something that you have the ability to control. Look for a place that treats a high volume of breast cancer. Look for a place that participates in federally funded clinical trials. That will guarantee you access to state-of-the-art care.
Dr. Monica Morrow is chief of breast surgery service with the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center located in New York City. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Breast cancer is the leading killer of women between the ages of 25 and 54. One woman who survived the deadly disease has decided to do something to help other women. The result is a festive fundraiser with a flowery theme. In the next part of our show, Cynthia Berger talks with Barbara Eakey, founder of Grow for Life, about the upcoming Lily Fest in Warren, Pennsylvania.
Barbara, you're the president and founder of the Grow for Life Breast Cancer Research and Education Foundation, and that name, Grow for Life, gives us a clue to how the foundation is organized. Explain how you get your support for breast cancer research and education.
Oh, well, we formed a board. There was a founding five, and then we expanded it to nine. And the board members do almost everything. And what we do is we get various sponsors. We have four national sponsors. And then we also have unbelievable, I mean, even for this event that's coming up on the 12th, we have over 100 sponsors.
You have a family connection to the floral industry.
That's right. That's right. And actually, that's why we chose the lily, which stands for strength, energy, and love, as our symbol. And what it is that when you go into a florist shop that makes donations to Grow for Life, if you buy a lily arrangement or send someone a lily arrangement or even buy lily cards or something like that, a percentage of that sales then is donated from that florist to Grow for Life. And it's wonderful. And we have garden centers doing this. We have hospital gift shops doing this. We have many different places doing this.
And is that just in the Warren area or more widely in Pennsylvania?
No, well, actually, Grow for Life is a national 501c3 public charity. So we have events all over the United States. But it started in Pennsylvania, but we have them all over the United States, and we have florists all over the United States make donation to us. We have people that are breast cancer survivors all over, and people that are lily enthusiasts too making donations to us. I mean, it's amazing. People find out about us and they say, oh, that's a great idea. And I love the fact that we give 60% to research and 40% to education. It goes into, since we're grassroots, money raised in a state helps battle breast cancer in that state. So it works out very nicely that and we don't have these high six-figure salaries. In fact, the board gets no reimbursement, no payment whatsoever. They just donate time and money, and they're fabulous. But we also have, we just will never have these huge salaries. So almost 100% of whatever someone donates goes to breast cancer research and education into that state that they would like to have it into that endowment.
And this is a very personal thing for you. Before you founded Grow for Life, I know you had quite an accomplished career in other fields as a teacher, a photojournalist, a playwright. If you wouldn't mind, just take us back to 1997 and to the events in your life that got you here as the president of a foundation talking about breast cancer. And I guess you were, at the time in 1997, you were in the middle of producing a musical.
Oh, I'll tell you, my life was going just great. And a month before our daughter's wedding, I lifted my arm and saw puckering in my breast, and I thought, that lump that you've been asking about is breast cancer. I knew it. So I didn't tell a soul. I went to the doctor and they said, yes, Barbara, we think you have breast cancer. And so I didn't tell a soul until 2 days after the wedding. I went to see the surgeon to have my breast cancer removed. And I actually, I consequently have had 7 surgeries.
Oh my.
And 9 surgical drains. And I've had 9 months of chemo and 6 weeks of radiation. And I haven't missed a heartbeat. And one of the reasons why I didn't miss this heartbeat is that my book, Trustee Solving Problems Through Creativity, was becoming an interactive musical. And I thought, I've got to have this happen. I mean, it's going to make such a difference in the lives of so many different people. So I didn't tell a soul about my breast cancer, except for my very, very good friends and immediate family. And I put on a wig, put a smile on my face, and off I went. And I did this interactive musical. Even the kids that were doing the performing of this did not know that I had breast cancer. I mean, it was rather amazing. And then after that, it went to Sweden to be performed. The interactive musical was premiered at Dickinson College, then Sweden, then Oberlin College, and then at Chautauqua Institution at Linné Hall.
Oh, that's great. That's really inspiring. But now, you mentioned the drains, and I wanted to talk about that. You were a patient. You're having some problems with your surgical drains. And so you're not only a writer, a playwright, but you're also an inventor. Tell us about that experience.
Well, I had horrible times with these surgical drains. It was just horrible. I could, you know, I'm a very, very active person. So therefore, that even in the hospital, they were a huge problem. And I kept thinking, this is not right. And they were painful because they pull and tug whenever I would get up and do something and whatever. 3-hour ride back. And all of a sudden, I thought, oh, Lord, we need to have something. So then I invented something called a drain duo, which actually is not now for 18 different types of post-surgical drains. And
right.
I also have a BioBuddy and a C-Cure strap. And
you hold several patents now for these
just,
devices
it's, but
that
what
are
I
helping
did,
other cancer survivors.
What I did, I've gotten to fabulous letters that. But more important has been Grow for Life. 3 years into it, I thought, I'm not giving enough to breast cancer research and education. So I decided, I'm going to start Grow for Life Breast Cancer Research and Education Foundation. And it combined everything that I know and am, got a group of 5 of us got together. We formed Grow for Life. We got our 501c3, so we're a national public charity. We got all these florists from across the United States because my husband's involved in the floral industry, and things have just gone fabulously. We have lily fests, and we also have various flower power picnics, but we're having a fabulous event on the 12th.
Let's talk about that specifically. That's your flower power picnic in Warren on the Allegheny River.
Uh-huh.
And just take us through it a step at a time. How many times have you had these kinds of events?
Oh, this lily, well, we've had many lily fests
but
across
this one,
the United
this
States.
One in Warren, tell
but
us about this
is,
that.
This is going to be on the 12th of July, and it's going to be from 10 a.m. to about 3 p.m.
And this is a fundraiser for
that's
your
a fundraiser. That's right. But you can come for free because there's going to be fabulous music. In fact, there's going to be a premiere of a music, actually a song that I wrote. It's called A Lily River Dance, and it's going to be sung by Mary Beth Whiting, going to be played by Fran Lito, and it's going to be danced by the Linda Dias Dance Unlimited, and it's going to be great. But it starts off with a lily float contest, and that's going to be crafts such as and vehicles such as canoes, kayaks, bikes, and wagons, and then
so all kinds of it's sort of a parade of all kinds of vehicles decorated with flowers.
That's right. It's going to have a huge breast cancer exhibit. When you're going to have to be able to make a donation, you can make a little tribute to a survivor or in memory of someone. We're going to have GFLII Lily Sports, which is Nintendo Wii, golf, tennis, or bowling, or bocce. And we're going to have, it's going to be so much fun. We have great Lily Fare, F-A-R-E, food, and everything's donated. All the flowers are donated, all the food is donated, all the huge prizes. If you get a hole-in-one in golf, guess what? You get a free car from Jones Chevrolet.
You've really organized a lot of fun things.
Oh, well, it hasn't been me. I actually am not the chair. The chair is Beth English and Todd Betts.
And how many people typically turn out for one of these events?
Well, we're thinking we already have 100 sponsors, so those people will turn out. So there's going to probably be about 200 or 300 people, or maybe even more. It's hard to tell because we're just getting the word out.
Grow for Life allocates 40% of the funds that it raises for education and 60% for research. Talk to us a little bit about who has benefited so far from the foundation.
Well, it's across the board, and it's usually we've given out grants to in seven states or nine states now. And what it is that a hospital that has a specific thing for breast cancer applies, makes an application, then that application is reviewed and we vote on the board of directors votes to approve it. And then they receive a grant, and then they have to follow up to prove that they've actually done the grant, and then they can apply for another grant the following year if they want. But it's gone to lots of different types of research, and it's gone to lots of different types of education.
Can you give some examples?
Well, some of them is like a library. It has to be a book that's not connected any way to another foundation or whatever else, or materials. They have lots of fabulous books that they do a lending library, a Grow for Life lending library at their hospital. Or they could do for research, it can be on aromatase inhibitors, which is what prevents estrogen from being absorbed into your body. Or it can be for displays, so how you do mammograms. In fact, the Lilly is really wonderful because we have a Lilly way of taking care of, we have Lilly care of breast and body. So
we just have a minute left for people who might like to attend the upcoming Lilly Fest in Warren. Just give us the date and the time one more time.
It's going to be July 12th, Saturday, July 12th at 11 a.m. to 3 p.m.
And where's that going to be?
Warren, Pennsylvania, Betts Park, and it's going to be grand fun.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Barbara Eakey, it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
Barbara Eakey is the founder and president of Grow for Life Breast Cancer Research and Education Foundation in Warren and a breast cancer survivor. For Take Note, I'm Cynthia Berger.
This program was produced in the studios of WPSU. If you have a story idea for Take Note, send an email to wpsu@psu.edu. Podcasts of this program are available at wpsu.org. This has been a production of Penn State Public Broadcasting.